Hey, everybody. Welcome to the School Sucks live show for August 16th, 2013. This is called a cold open because we don't have any bumper music set up. I am still in Connecticut in the Tragedy and Hope studio. And on the Skype with me tonight is an old friend of the show at this point, Kevin Cole. How are you doing tonight?
Pretty good. How are you?
Good. And Kevin is currently working on a book, the title of that book, The Great Chain of Being and the Organic Unity of the Polis. Can you tell us a little bit about what you have in the works there, Kevin?
Sure. I'm working on a book that deals with the concept of the trivium, going back into the historical liberal arts that originate with Isocrates and ancient Greece and his attempts to rescue ancient Greece from immediate decline. And so what I'm doing is tracing the path of the historical liberal arts, the trivium and quadrivium, whether it be the seven liberal arts or sometimes eight or sometimes nine or sometimes 10, and to explore how this concept of a total education or encyclopedia has been used to keep minds encapsulated rather than keeping them open to new ideas. And it's how systems and governmental structures, monarchies, have perpetuated themselves for many, many years. And it's still a concept they find very much beneficial in the United States with compulsory schooling. And it'll go into how the concept of the trivium has a lot to do with the Prussian education system, where they may seem to be dichotomously opposed when dealing with the trivium method, which is to help you find certainty in your everyday life. The classical trivium was more of a specific canon of authors that you would read in order to pick up a ethical substrata or prescriptive ethical philosophy that they felt would keep in line with whether it be the Roman Empire or the Roman Catholic Church or the British Empire. This is the crux of what the history of the liberal arts has a lot more to do with the history of mind control and of state maintenance and creating a obedient class of individuals that will serve government and serve other state apparatus.
So I guess one way to describe it metaphorically would be delivering packages to learners that cannot be taken apart any further. Like, oh, here's a whole piece. We'll call it knowledge. You don't have to dissemble it yourself and look at what's inside. Is that what you're suggesting as far as the trivium being used for that type of control?
Sure. Well, it really goes back to ancient Greece and where you would have the public square and where people would be out there. Some people might be good at grammar. Some people might be good at logic and they're teaching logical methods, or some might just be great speakers, but they're not using logic. And then there might be the mathematician, people that are among the square and the Acropolis and would teach others. And what Isocrates did was he took these arts from out into the public square, where there was a more of a free learning system, and encapsulated them into what he called the Enkyklios Paideia. And in doing so, he creates this artificial scarcity to say, here, look, this is all the knowledge you need to be a total citizen and to exist within our city state. So it was more about trying to take these ideas that were freely available with natural human reason and to encapsulate them within a said normalcy, or the in definition of what is a total education. And that's really where the trivium and quadrivium start. Isocrates is the one who, 6 years before Plato even thought about starting a school, he's the one who takes grammar, logic, and rhetoric and puts them in that order. But it's all based on a strict canon of previous authors and Homeric epics and all these things that they thought, if were taken in with the proper type of analysis, would craft the type of citizen necessary for Greece to survive. We know that didn't happen. And the Roman Empire then took these technologies that Isocrates had developed and that Plato picked up and that Aristotle dealt with as well, and took those technologies and merged it with Christianity. And then Christianity held on to these methods of teaching and learning and encapsulated knowledge, which, you know, and merged it with Christian theological thought. This is where the number seven gets kind of a spiritual definition. This, you know, it was arbitrary. There were 10 arts. There were 11 arts. Throughout history, it wasn't fixed at seven. It was only fixed at seven because there was a numerical calculation in the Bible that they felt, you know, if you had the seven columns and the seven pillars and the seven liberal arts, it would flow better. And so when you look at the birth of compulsory schooling, Alcuin of York is an individual who actually created the word trivium. Grammar, Logic, and Rhetoric went as Grammar, Logic, and Rhetoric for many years before the word trivium was ever applied to it. And that was only done during the time of Charlemagne, when he became the right-hand man and teacher at all of his royal schools. But it was always to teach the higher classes. It wasn't for the masses. So where Benedictine or other orders prior to the Benedictine order, the friars and such, would used to be taught by preachers that would come to their house and ask their parents, hey, I'd like to take your son or daughter, son usually, under my wing and teach them these arts and, you know, bring them into our order. Well, Alcuin is the one who said, hey, it'd be much more beneficial if we just create a palace school and have everybody come here. So he's really the birth of compulsory schooling, but it starts within these monastic orders. And then that filters out into the larger population as the populace and as the masses grow, and later on in the British Empire. So it's really what I'm trying to show is this concept of education and Enkyklios Paideia has survived for 21 generations. And the more that I can show the historicity of this, the more beneficial the trivium method of critical thinking can have something to be juxtaposed to, and therefore even more beneficial to people to use. So it's just trying to delineate between those ideas that I found fascinating.
And who do you see as the audience for the readership for the book?
Well, I think anybody that's interested in history, because it's going to deal with a lot of how the American Revolution was started, as well as what the American Revolution was actually fighting against. There's a lot of things that the American people have forgot about what the supposed intentions were. And I think there's a huge historical gap between the War of 1812 and the 1900s, where we get this special relationship with Great Britain. And then you really get into a lot of the ideas tied into the Rhodes Milner Roundtable Group. So really, anybody that's interested in history, I'm writing it because I think it's something that needs to be said. I think I've found some connections that are meaningful and that have not been discussed before. And I think there is a little bit of a danger of equating things historically to a method that is not actually what that was in the past. So as long as people understand that the trivium method is something new and not, you know, something that developed in ancient Greece and that we were kind of neglected through our public schooling, it's more of a negation of common sense and common reason, you know, which is kind of the basis of the American Revolution. It was looking back on the absurdity that this small island could govern a whole nation. So right. There's a lot of things we could discuss in there, and you know, but it really has to do with the concepts of authority and the concepts of developing a body politic. And I have definite proof that individuals within the Rhodes Milner Roundtable Group were seeking to reinstate the classical trivium in the United States. They said technology to the rescue, and they were working with Harvard University and James Conant, in order to bring the trivium technology or a general education to the United States. So I think it kind of spells out and continues a lot of the work that John Taylor Gatto has done. And that the title for the book actually has some influence from Mr. Gatto himself, because I was running by a few titles with him, and he said go with that one because he liked it better than the other one that I had. So it's really a continuation of some of the work that John Taylor Gatto has done, as well as some of the connections between Carol Quigley's that really drive me and motivate me to share this.
Okay, that's an interesting question. That leads us to our topic tonight, which I introduced to my audience as historical research methods and challenges. You've been on the show once at this point, where we talked about Cecil Rhodes, the Round Table Groups, Tragedy and Hope, and the larger picture surrounding that. People responded saying that they were certainly very impressed with the amount of integration that you had been able to do, and also the recall, how you could make that relevant to what we were talking about. So Kevin is a historical researcher, soon to be author. You've participated in the Tragedy and Hope series, History So It Doesn't Repeat. In fact, this book that you're talking about, I think you covered a topic very similar to that about the historical trivium versus modern applications. So one place that I like to start with people is, you know, a little bit about your waking up, right? Because that's where your motivation begins. And as I've mentioned so many times on the show in the past, you know, motivation is the key to meaningful learning and lasting knowledge. So how did that happen for you, Kevin? And when?
Well, that's a long story, but it's a great question. It's not one I've been asked before. So, well, let me give a little bit of background. I was born and raised in the D.C. metro area outside of Washington, D.C. So I've kind of always been around a, you know, strong political climate. As people that know, people that live within the Beltway know that it's a constant cycle of news and regurgitation with what's going on politically. But on top of that, I attended church at a young age where my mother worked in Washington, D.C. at a church called the First Baptist Church of Washington, D.C. This church is famous for having Harry Truman as a member during his presidency. They also tried to set up this church along with the birth of George Washington University as kind of like a federal church for the United States. Later, Jimmy Carter attended the church. And later, when I was around, President Bill Clinton attended the church. So I've kind of always been around political figures within, as a little kid growing up in the area. And I think the civics education probably is a little stronger there. So maybe I would say more so my parents' influence in understanding what's going on in the world and being able to discern, you know, fact from fiction on political issues that kind of got me, you know, interested in that. And then being able to understand the way the government was set up and where these different principles derived is something that I've always been fascinated with. Obviously, as a young kid, I was 13 years old, and, you know, Bill Clinton attended the inaugural prayer service at the church that I attended in Washington, D.C. Now, this was a Baptist church, but it was ran by a kind of a theologian, scholar, preacher. It wasn't fire and damnation, and I was usually playing basketball in the gymnasium most of the time. So it wasn't as if I was really inculcated into a Christian environment. It was more that I was kind of brought up, you know, to kind of take some of those lessons in and understand them and then go on my own way. But it was interesting to, you know, to see things from that perspective where, you know, Bill Clinton is coming there to pray before he gets inaugurated president the next day. And then you get older and you start figuring out that, well, Bill Clinton has this other interesting history where he went to Georgetown University and he attended classes of a professor by the name of Carol Quigley.
Right. So how did that happen? How did you figure that out?
How did I figure that out?
What was aha moment, you know? Or maybe there's a series of them, but...
Sure. Well, the first time I ever heard of Tragedy and Hope was probably in like 1999.
Wow.
And I never followed up on it. I had listened to, you know, some alternative media on the internet, as well as through people that would share discs or cassettes where they had burned off of somewhere, whether it be William Cooper or, you know, maybe early on some of Alex Jones's work. But I'd also always been kind of a reader, you know, a voracious reader. I like to read. So the first time I ever really looked into Tragedy and Hope didn't happen until way after 9/11. You know, so I had this kind of ideas of who Carol Quigley was and that there was this book. And I had heard Stan Monteith's work on Freemasonry and, you know, his own, you know, he comes from his own angle and his own beliefs. But it was, you know, interesting way to kind of look into those ideas. I'd say before George Bush got elected or stole the election, if you look into the Choice Point information from Florida, I kind of had a feeling that things were going to go bad if this individual got elected, you know, if he got selected. Whether 9/11 would have happened either way, that's another, you know, conversation that we can have. It wouldn't have been any better with Al Gore, I suppose. But yeah, with 9/11, that really was the moment that got me to take seriously a lot of things that I had seen incorporated and not, you know, put into action or not, you know, really went further with. So I'd say 9/11 and then getting involved with Richard through the Project Constellation transmission in 2006. And working with the online community, and then finally getting to a point where I'm ready to use my voice to share what I've learned. So I think that I hope that answers your question.
Yeah, absolutely. So when did you come in and actually start working with them? You know, doing research that could be compiled and used for either the podcast or other projects.
Well, I first contacted Rich in 2006. I think it was like right around 9/11 Synchronicity episode 4. I had submitted a song. He'd put on an earlier episode. He said, if anybody out there makes your own music and would like to, you know, submit it, if it's relevant information, or I'd probably play it. So he played a song that I had sent him, and we corresponded via email, I'd say, for 3 or 4 years, you know, before we even really talked on the phone, maybe in 2009. We got together via telephone and helped with some liaison work in the D.C. area. And then I was able to finally travel up there to do the Ultimate History lesson. So I was fortunate enough to man a camera and get to talk to John and work on the transcript for that. And that's really when I first met Richard and Lisa in person.
Mm. So as far as the process that you go through, because, I mean, we've seen the end result, right, in the presentations that you've done on YouTube or on my show. We've talked maybe a little bit about motivation. How do you decide what to pursue, and then what do you typically do next? Like, where do you begin?
Well, it depends on what specific topic we're discussing. But I have incorporated the use of the personal brain software, which I believe you and Rich did a show covering some of the aspects of that recently.
Yeah.
When Richard turned me on to that, it was a godsend. It's a great organizational tool in order to really make solid connections. And I really do think it helps you remember things in a way that maybe you wouldn't compartmentalize them in your mind before. I've always been somebody that kind of has a photographic memory on certain issues and things that I'm interested in. I might forget a face 5 minutes later, though. So as far as process goes, I incorporate the personal brain. I do a lot of reading, and I read both the conflicting reports. I'll read Foreign Affairs from Council on Foreign Relations, and I'll read something that is the opposing dichotomy of that to see, what really is being put out there for agendas, and what is out there in order to inform people and help them make decisions in their own lives. So that's really part of the process. It really comes down to turning off the television and doing some serious reading, because you're not going to find the facts that are relevant to history and that are to our daily lives through most of the things that are on television these days.
Now, do you ever think that that's kind of a useful supplement to see what is being put out there in mainstream media? I think we've seen a lot of current events in recent times where it's actually quite instructive to go and look what the official narrative. Sometimes it can be a little disturbing.
Sure.
I remember the Bin Laden story. I was at 2012, I think 2011, 2012, as far as his demise at that time. I found that very troubling, watching the official narrative for that being constructed in the mainstream media. There's a couple other examples I can think of. The details aren't important, but I think it is interesting to see how an official story, even if there is some truth in it or not, but how through mainstream media an official story is created. So do you ever use that as, you're trying to make connections to build that bridge between then and now, in understanding a better contextual understanding of what's happening today?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I find myself, checking in on some of the establishment media in order to, determine what they're really trying to tell you. And I think that is very beneficial. It's beneficial, when you juxtapose, like you said, the death of Osama bin Laden versus previous news reports that he was already passed on and that he was on dialysis and that he was in a cave and then no, he wasn't. And then he pops up in Pakistan where there's cozy relationships all around, but yet nobody can turn him, nobody will turn that guy in if that was the case. So, yeah, I absolutely, I try to consume as much of it as possible, but, always recognizing that, they have other agendas at play, as is evidenced with every commercial break. And most of the stories, nowadays are dealing with fluff or dealing with issues that they are then trying to collectivize to the larger population in order to, to put in, different agendas that are already, prefixed. So I think it's definitely beneficial to do so. But I think it can also be detrimental if you're not using a filter or a lens to try to determine, who's telling you what and what their history is and why that anchor got hired by that network and whose mother is, just interesting stories along the way. So I absolutely think it's good to stay on top of that as long as you're critically thinking.
Sure. Yeah. And in addition to the intellectual self-defense, I think there's also an emotional self-defense that's required, because spending too much time in that world, whether it's online or, through your television, it can be pretty spirit crushing to see what's being pushed out there. So,
sure.
Yeah, I think that it's a good world to check into. People were a little. I definitely got a few questions about my recommendation to listen to talk radio a couple hours a week from my audience. They said, "Well, I'm not going to do that." But you need to monitor. I think your response to it as well, because there certainly is an emotional impact to consuming too much of that.
Sure. Yeah, talk radio is a whole nother beast, especially when you look into how monopolized the radio airwaves are in the United States and what agendas are being pushed by certain companies that have been controlling, you know, the largest markets for many, many years. So, every once in a while, when, you know, popping in a CD or changing the auxiliary plug between driving down the road, you'll, you know, pop in on some talk radio and kind of hear what they're trying to tell middle America or tell, you know, whatever part of the country or what type of, agenda. It just, people underestimate the power of listening to these talking heads every day and what it can do to your own psyche and kind of give you blind spots that you shouldn't have had along the way, because there's always an agenda in mind, whether they're telling you it's right versus left and that they have both represented or they're fair and balanced or whatever it is. You can tell there's always an agenda in mind, as is evidenced by commercial breaks. So
sure. Yeah, it also brings to mind the idea of information overload, which, a lot of people who are consuming that media on a regular basis with the misconception that it's information and news and what's going on in the world. But, I was talking to somebody today who was really excited that, you know, they were saying, oh, I'm reading Getting Things Done and I'm studying the Trivium. And I just feel overloaded by information. Now, you're doing or have done those things. But you're also involved in so much more. So I think it's also worth talking about managing the inputs. I was in school from 1983 to 1995. And in those 12 years, something that was certainly not a part of my education, and really I don't fault the school system or any of my teachers for this, because how could they have known? The world in which I would be an adult and the way that I would be able to interface with information or misinformation. So when I was in elementary school from, 1983 to 1989, I don't think any of those people or even, educational planners on a district or state or federal level could have anticipated the way information would flow 15 or 20 years later. So I think there are a lot of people who are easily overwhelmed. That was, a comment that I got from the show I just did, reading a small Rothbard book from the show we just did together, about 5 weeks ago. A couple of people said that's overwhelming. That's a lot to process at once. So if you are presenting your findings, your conclusions, that's obviously going through a funnel of what you think is worth communicating to other people. But on the other end, the wider end, there's so much more information. So what have you tried to do, or what strategies have you used or tools have you used to, avoid that information overload that I think is so common in doing this kind of historical research, especially with the tools that we have available to us today?
Yeah, well, I think some useful tools in order to avoid that would be to, set a goal for what you're trying to accomplish and what you're trying to learn. Obviously, it helps for it to be something that you're interested in. If we're talking about, material related to Tragedy and Hope or these other books that are 1,300 pages long, these are hard to tackle. But there's always ways of circumventing things that appear to be hard. I mean, there are audiobooks available on the internet if you search of Tragedy and Hope, and there are other ways of kind of graduating this information so you can build up your attention span and be able to, participate in your own learning. Because I'll find sometimes I'll pick up a book that I'm really excited to read and I'll blow through it, and then all of a sudden, oh, what did I actually retain here? So, for me, I use, anybody that's seen any of my books, I use tabs in all of my books. I keep track of all of the relevant quotes, things that I have found that are in synchronicity with other points that I think are relevant. And I try to keep track of and highlight where necessary and use these resources in a way that you can, present it to other people. I understand not everybody has time to sit around and read books, and so it's by consuming podcasts and finding other people that have looked into these that can give you a valid perspective that'll give you a little bit of a ramp for you to go check it out yourself. because you don't want to just take in what anybody else's opinion is of it. I don't want anybody to read my book and say, well, his conclusions are all right. What I want to be able to do is to provide a resource that provides the citations necessary that one can come to either the conclusion that I've came to, or they can present a challenge to the conclusions that I've drawn. Because I don't claim to not have, you know, inborn biases, just like anybody else might, from whatever perspective in life that we come from. And it's only by getting together and discussing these ideas and bouncing them off of each other and seeing where they are truly relevant that we can, you know, that we can learn about what we're doing here. Because I think that, you know, we're all kind of in a situation where much of our history has been glossed over in three or four paragraphs. You know, you look back into how much your high school covered of the American Revolution, and I'll tell you mine. I went to high school here in Illinois, and we didn't cover the American Revolution with any kind of depth that is necessary for somebody to understand the reasoning for why this country separated from Great Britain, let alone, you know, what atrocities were committed on the native peoples that were, you know, out in the backyard here.
Right.
So, you know, there's a relevance. It really, you know, it's not for me to be able to tell somebody what they can do. It really, it comes to a realization in one's own life that there's a bunch of history that people kind of just buy into because there are authorities. And if you look into the root word of authority, that actually comes from the auctors, which is the authors. And then we're talking about storytelling. So when you're telling a story, it's up to the reader to be able to determine whether or not these points that are being made are valid.
Mm.
And so when you look into, you know, the causes of the American Revolution and the writings of Thomas Jefferson and the Declaration of Independence, his own contradictions immensely, you know, withstanding from my point here, you know, it really came down to a nominalistic rejection of authority, of the auctor, those that claim to be the authority of the day. Now, they weren't against maybe keeping some of the same ways of looking at nature and adopting Linnaeus's system of, you know, categorizing different species. But it was really a trying to dethrone a unified culture and to create its own. So I think, you know, when you're talking about that and the concept of organic unity in what I'm discussing in the book, you know, it's totally relevant to everybody's life who's breathing at this moment and many more. Because we're talking about how societies are managed, how myths are kept up over time, and how people kind of live in a state of non-reality in relation to things that are directly, you know, important to their life. Where, you know, we no longer play an active part in the idealized version of what this government is, that we could have somebody else represent us, whether or not that's actually possible, you know, by the laws of nature for somebody else to physically represent you. You know, but we don't even get back to the idealized form of what it was supposed to be to have the conversation. And I think that's one of the problems with history and with historiography, is that it's constantly an evolving perception and evolving changing of what happened in history in order to suit the present.
Yeah, I want to make sure we clearly define that term as well for those in my audience who might be unfamiliar. Historiography, in a nutshell, is basically the study of historical perspective. So my story with that, the big wake-up for me many years ago was reading, you can take it or leave it today, but Howard Zinn's People's History of the United States, even though it was certainly written with a very forceful political slant, it made me aware of the idea that history is not chemistry as far as how it's presented in school, right? You can open a chemistry book and read through it, and, you know, in the latest edition of, I mean, science is ever-changing as well, but there's probably not a series of tremendous, inexcusable mistakes in a chemistry book. Now, history in school, whether we're talking about primary, secondary, or college, is presented as something that has already been agreed upon. I think it was Napoleon who called it a lie, agreed upon. But as if, like, these are facts, this work has been done, you can use this book to learn about it like you do in chemistry or algebra, and that's it. So being exposed to a social history of the United States from an entirely unique perspective as far as what had been presented in government school was very eye-opening. It wasn't safe. It wasn't free of controversy. Not everything had a happy ending perfectly at the end of a chapter. So, you know, that study of historical perspective was very important. And I think we can go a little bit more into detail with that as well. Different ways of looking at history as a whole. We've talked a lot on my show in the past about what I'll call, I don't know if this is Dan Carlin's term or not. He was the first one I heard use it. The trends and forces theory of history, which really deals with comparative history, where we look for repeating patterns from society to society or culture to culture. We've done it with the United States and Germany. There are a lot of parallels there. Recently, we've played around with comparative history between the United States and the Eastern Bloc, during the Cold War. Another theory is, or another lens through which we can view history is the great man theory. And this is really, I think this is dangerous because this is really biographical history. So it leads more, from my experience anyway, it leads more to an authority worship presentation. So we see these events usually from some very important or pivotal time in history through, again, the lens of usually a powerful, if we're talking about America, usually a Caucasian man, an example of this would be the author Doris Kearns Goodwin, who is like the high priestess in the church of politician worship, as far as I'm concerned. In some of her books, No Ordinary Time, about, you know, the presidency of Franklin Delano Roosevelt. She wrote a book about Lyndon Johnson. She wrote Team of Rivals, which was later turned into Steven Spielberg's Lincoln. And, these people are on my list of worst presidents. And she presents them as these hero visionaries through that great man theory or biographical lens of teaching history. So, I think that there's obviously problems with the trends and forces theory. There are tremendous problems with the great man theory because it doesn't neither really address what's going on behind the scenes and neither really address the wild cards or the accidents or the chance events or the hand of God events of history. So there are many lenses through which we can view history. Some have more strengths than others. I think all of them certainly have shortcomings. But in a nutshell, that is historiography. Do you have anything that you want to add to that, Kevin?
Yeah, no, that was a great definition. And you really touched on something that I wanted to talk about. And what it really comes down to is the solidification of the creation of disciplines. So when you're talking about, they set this textbook in front of you and you say, okay, this is history. Well, it goes back to the creation of what is world history, and the concept also discussed in the Trivium talk that I did with Richard and Lisa is the concept of neologisms, the creation of new words in order to create new realities. And this is really a concept that was used very heavily during the American Revolution by people like Thomas Paine, John Adams, Thomas Jefferson, James Madison, and Noah Webster with his spellers and these other dictionaries that he created in order to create a new American language to step outside of the British language, because the American Revolution and thereafter didn't have the advantage of being able to craft a whole new language in which to, insulate itself from its previous oppressor. So what they tried to do was to create new words that would create new realities. If I would ask you, put you on the spot and ask you, what would the word you would use be for the government's killing millions of people?
At home or abroad?
Anywhere, just throughout history.
Well, since governments are usually, at least in the 20th century, killing their own people, I would call that democide.
There you go. And this word democide has now given people a whole new paradigm in which to present the history of governments killing human beings. Before that, you would just say, governments throughout history have been known to kill this amount of people. But right. now we have this overarching concept that we can use and say democide that carries the connotations. And then that can be proliferated in a way that expands people's awareness where it's much easier to do. So if you look back in history and you look at somebody like Arnold Toynbee, who was involved as an educational historian and a historian with the Milner Rhodes Roundtable Group, he created the discipline of world history. And he did this in the lineage of his mentor, who brought him into the Rhodes-Milner Roundtable Alfred Zimmern, who is largely credited as being the individual who created the discipline of international relations. So when you look at Carroll Quigley's work and how he views how he views the world throughout history, Carroll Quigley is not a historian that's concerned with Americans' place in the world, American history. He is a history of Western civilization. This is another one of those overarching terms that creates a whole new paradigm in which people can see a broader history. So if you're a historian of Western civilization like Carroll Quigley, you find that he says, I'm really worried that Western civilization is going to fall. That's the tragedy. And the hope is that, you know, maybe we can do something about it. Maybe not. But it's this concept of Western civilization that he's trying to save. He's not trying to save the American way of government or any of these other things with national sovereignty or individualism or any of this. He's trying to save Western civilization, just like the international relations community, which was totally created by the Rhodes Milner Roundtable Group. When Carroll Quigley, in his audio and in his work, says that the Roundtable Journal of Commonwealth Affairs created the best source on international relations at the time, well, that's because international relations used to be the first person act of dealing with the other country. You know, but once the public got access via technology and via media and the printing press and all these other things, it expands the circle. And so what we're talking about here is discipline creation as strategy for changing the world order. And so when you're mentioning, you know, these authoritative texts and the way that they want you to buy into those ideas as all the end all be all, whether that be the Bible or whether it be any other religious text or whether it be something they're trying to teach you historically, you have to know that there's always something else out here and there's a motivation for people to whitewash over certain ideas. And so I think that the concept of neologisms and the concept of discipline creation in order to create new realities is a very sly technique in order to keep people off of their game. And it can also be a very useful tool in order for us to create our own new realities that describe things that make them easily, told to other people.
Sure. Okay, we're going to pause for a minute. There are some feedback coming in from the chat regarding technical issues that we might be having, and I just want to check my phone. So that's a break that we're taking. Okay. Let me just see if I have...
I'm thinking about a couple minutes here.
Yeah.
I'll just get a drink.
Right behind them. See you.
Step away and get a drink if you want to take a couple minutes, but
plug in the... Okay, let's see. Yeah, I'm gonna take a drink too. Can somebody update me on you can jump up if you need to. Can somebody update me on the sound? Sounds good. So it's okay now? All right, when he comes back, I'm gonna ask if he has the capabilities to record. You know, here's a thing that you think of usually before the show, if you're a pro. Kevin, can you record your own audio? I would have said, with the proper planning. Someone says, I'm going to take a drink. What are you drinking? What are you drinking on? I enjoy Polar Seltzer, pomegranate. Now, they are getting real creative with the flavors of this stuff. Hey, I have a question for you. Do you have the capability to record audio on your end?
Me?
Yeah.
Let me see. I've just had a hard drive crash recently, so I don't know if I've reloaded my utility or not.
All right. Oh, if you're watching this on YouTube, this is part two. All right, so there's a word that we've mentioned a couple of times that I want to make sure people are also clear on: historicity or ahistoricity. And this is essentially the historical accuracy or authenticity, and really looking at like the historicity of an individual or a group of individuals involves the question of how real was their role. So, for example, the historicity of Jesus, or the historicity of, you know, maybe certain founding fathers or military figures, or, well, I guess he was a founding father, Paul Revere's ride, you know, what is the historicity of that? So the examination of the historical accuracy and real involvement of individuals or groups, or even, I guess it could translate to ideas. Any thoughts on that?
Yeah, I think what it really comes down to in the context of what you're mentioning would be the original intent or the original framing of an event. So much of our history, rightly or wrongly, or just naturally by people's inborn biases, gets presented in a way that is trying to change people's minds rather than present them with the actual facts and occurrences so they can make their own decisions. If we're talking about the historicity of somebody else's work, you kind of look at, what kind of biases they may bring to the table, but also examine the individual facts that you're discussing to see if, it gels with, the matter at hand. It really depends on what we're talking about. But, it's really the study of the actual events and the original intent of either the author or the period of time that you're discussing.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think this kind of relates back to the historiography questions as well, and specifically the great man theory or the biographical history. So I'm taking some artistic license with my example here, but let's say some sycophantic academic writes a book like, Woodrow Wilson, the great progressive visionary or something like that, or, just some George Bush book that would go nicely on the bookshelf with John Grisham books, Decision Point.
The Greatest Generation.
The Decider. Yeah, something like that, that is, taking all of these complex events and viewing them through the lens of a person who probably wasn't honest with their biographers anyway. I don't mean to sound accusatory, but that starts to create these distortions that lead to a certain ahistoricity, because then what we wind up with, because these stories of heroes and great men and women are so compelling and so warm and fuzzy, there's an agreed upon narrative that when you translate it back into the big picture of history, that really is in many ways, bringing Doris Kearns Goodwin's name back into this, delivered through the obedience and the worship of academics. And you see this again and again in these biographies of these great men and great political figures. So how does that actually tie back to what we were talking about before, Kevin, and the concept of organic unity, that agreed upon narrative?
Well, it's when you're talking about what you mentioned with Doris Kearns Goodwin and these individuals arbitrarily picking these presidents to put up on a mantle, it's like other people trying to build monuments to these individuals. And so you're trying to kind of create a future historical narrative that use one philosophy that one might have carried over another. So some of the work I've done on the book goes into the concept of the great books of the Western world and where the great books of the Western world originated. If you look into the history of that, you'll find that it goes back to the X Club with Thomas Henry Huxley, as well as John Woodruff, who sought out to create a list of the 100 greatest authors. And because it was coming from these scholarly individuals, you're supposed to look at it and say, well, these are the greatest 100 people they could have included, when there are many, many people around the world and many other cultures and different perspectives in lives that are negated from those things. And so following the concept of the great book in trying to elevate it, that is all to do with the Encyclios Paideia in the Encyclopedia and really with the Encyclopedia Britannica, which gets used, which is formerly a British creation that was meant to combat the philosophies of Diderot and his encyclopedia around the French Revolution. But it later gets bought out in the United States, and they use it to try to reinstitute the trivium and quadrivium liberal arts circular education. This is the end-all, be-all of all education, take it or leave it. And these individuals were all part of the Rhodes-Milner Roundtable, which I'll go into in more detail later. Now, with the concept of organic unity as it relates specifically to the work I'm doing with the concept of the great chain of being, it goes back to that organic unity is applied to the great chain of being as a degree to which one's worldview maintains an equilibrium with its foundational ideas. You kind of find this conveyed as a form that consists of independent attributes, like a body being composed of organs that operate in conjunction with one another, or is applied to even experiences or different concepts in consciousness or beliefs or attitudes. So modern day examples of this can be seen in occupational or societal roles, social roles that are dominant within a specific culture, and things that become normative or moral or ethical in any social group. But even larger, organic unity also applies to the continuity of a common theme. So when we're talking about the Last Will and Testament of Cecil John Rhodes, who set up, you know, his own story that he hoped other people would continue, and by creating the Rhodes Scholarships and by creating these interdependent roundtable organizations that were meant to proliferate out into the world, he hoped to control not only the story, his story, history, but he also hoped to control the future of the British Dominion as well as the United States within that dominion. So organic unity is it's a complex topic, but it's directly related to this concept of the great chain of being, which was organized by Plotinus and picked up by Plato and also Isocrates as well. And it is directly responsible, the great chain of being, this idea that somewhere down the line, you know, a god or some gods came down and said, well, this word means that, and this word means this, and here's the first estate, and here's the second estate, and the lower estates that would become the divine right of kings, and how bishops and priests and archbishops would be organized within medieval secular society or within a religious construct.
Yeah, let me ask you, and so, let me just ask you a question real quick, and then I'll let you go on. I wonder how deliberate the transmission and the perpetuation of this really is. And like, let's take Rhodes, for example. When you're saying that he created a story, do we have any reason to believe, and you would know better than me, did he believe it? Do we have any reason to believe that he made it up, or did he actually believe what he was saying, maybe because of how he was influenced, and perhaps even, I know I'm speculating here, obedient to somebody like Ruskin, his professor at Oxford, who told, you know, we owe it to these people out there, these savages.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. I think that's a great point. I think, while it is his story that he concocted, and it may have been a culmination of other people's ideas or of a culmination of really the dominant ideology at the time, you know? And so when you look at John Ruskin and you look at somebody like J.R. Seeley, and you look at John Calvin, even, I mean, if you look at Cecil Rhodes' original plans for the Rhodes Secret Society, the inner core of just him and a few of the main players was to be called the Society of the Elect. Well, that's John Calvin. You're talking about a group of individuals who are directly adherent to the same ideology that there is a group of individuals who are preordained by God because of their faculties or their Anglo-Saxon heritage, or because they believe the British race is the finest race in the world, and you know this is something that they perpetuated. I think he believed it. I think, you know, he believed it to such an extent that he viewed anything and opposed to it as savages, and he sought to either incorporate them into the life that he wanted them to live and the type of society that he wanted to perpetuate, or they were basically animals. And you see that perpetuated not only by Cecil Rhodes, but you see it perpetuated by Jan Christian Smuts, who is the developer of the concept of holism, which basically codifies in an ecological manner this very same corrupt ideology, that there is a balance in nature and that man is the dictate of that balance, and that you need to put African Americans over here and you need to put white people over here, put these certain animals over here and these over here, and trying to impart a balance onto the world that it does not exist because the world exists in flux constantly.
So these things, you know, whether we're talking about this British hypernationalism in the 19th century or this scientism, you know, science as a religion, we're in the realm of mythology. I think that another important factor with the perpetuation of this narrative is obedience. And I know I mentioned that before, but, you know, we see it in psychiatry, we see it in education, we see it in the military, we see it in police work. So do you think that, you know, people's allegiance to what came before or their trust in authority, I mean, that has to be an integral part of the transmission and perpetuation of this story, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. I think, you know, you've hit on a really good point there, because, you know, is it something that is natural where people are easily led? We can, you know, try to break down some of these individual points that you're making. I would say that, you know, it's it's a larger issue of trying to keep a hold of what is happening historically. You know, with the United States, for instance, you know, the United States is isolated from the world at the period of the American Revolution, and they're developing all of these different treaties and things that say we want to have neutrality and we want to stay out of foreign wars. And, you know, this whole period of time goes by in which, you know, that is able to change from a country of isolationists, essentially, people that would rather deal with in trade and deal with in commerce, but, you know, stay out of these foreign entanglements. And then that gets changed over all of a sudden to a country that is hyper militaristic and nobody knows why. And that's kind of what I was saying earlier. You know, if we don't pay attention to these historical markers and you know, keep on top of them, I don't see how we can, you know, ever find relevance to them. And I think that's what they count on, because, you know, it's kind of the climate that we're in. What was the rest of your question there?
No. I think you answered it. I wanted to make sure that we put that into the record as a factor in how this continues. You know, and obviously the obedience and the sort of blind worship of authority, pretty ubiquitous in most of the things that we talk about. So,
yeah, well, and I really just think it comes from ignorance, and it also helps when there is a captive audience. So, I mean, there's been a compulsory education system in this country that is not in any way, you know, reinforcing, you know, American nationalism, if that's what people want to perpetuate. And it's certainly not enforcing any of the history in order to understand what that was about, in order to grow beyond that. Because I think the only way that we're going to get to a place that where people are autonomous and sovereign in their own being, and that people can, you know, recognize that they don't need to dominate each other, and that we have these individual natural rights, we're going to have to go back through the same path that we came. We have to understand what took place and what the American Revolution was all about in the first place, to see why some of these individuals might have been wrong in setting it up the way they did. I think it was Thomas Jefferson. I don't have the exact quote in front of me, but, you know, for all of his, you know, faults and atrocities, he said, you know, I'm increasingly convinced that the earth belongs to the living and that no man has the right to rule over any other man. So be it. I don't know the exact end of the quote there. But the point here that I'm making is, here's somebody that was dealing with the very real, you know, oppression by foreign rule, and trying to concoct a system that would not perpetuate the exact same thing. And if you read into the letters of John Adams to Thomas Jefferson, that's what most of their correspondence has been about, because you find that throughout John Adams' life, he strays, and he wants to, you know, call the president his majesty, and then he wants to, you know, copy the balance of government strategy that is born out of the concept of organic unity, except he wants to apply it to new principles. And then you have Thomas Jefferson, who gets accused of being a French Jacobin. And then you also have him, you know, speaking favorably of groups like the Illuminati, and a group that wanted to have no state whatsoever. But, you know, people tend to gloss over Thomas Jefferson's glowing review of Adam Weishaupt, mm-hmm. when they're posting all of his positive quotes that are still relevant to today. So I think that's another thing. As far as historicity goes, there are some gaps to be filled in as to, you know, people that are against the Illuminati who don't know what it historically was, what it had to do with, and, you know, what it was fighting against at the time, albeit having many, many things that were wrong with it and awful, and being taken over by other people. But my point in that is that, you know, it's always important to discover both sides of an issue. It's so easy to get online, do one little search, and say, I think I've got it. But there's always another part of that. And there's something that's not being put out there, you know, for public consumption as well.
Yeah. So that being said, you know, I think there might be a few people, if not, you know, quite a few people in my audience who start to move towards the edge of their seat a little bit when they hear the word Illuminati, or, you know, maybe some people who start moving towards the door when they hear that.
Yeah.
And you know, I think that's a reaction, because that word has become so wrapped up in, you know, so many ridiculous narratives of conspiracy. But I think that it also relates what you just said, and our efforts here to clearly define these two terms, historicity and historiography. I wanted to make sure that people were clear on that, because you recently wrote an article that, you know, all of this comes into play. It was called Professor Carol Quigley and the Article That Said Too Little. And I assume that is a play on the 1970s article which was mm-hmm. called The Professor Who Knew Too Much.
Yes, so, that's correct.
You know, this is, or there's also a subtitle here that I should mention, Reclaiming History from Omission and Partisan Straw Man. And, you know, we were talking before the show about that audio that we've heard of this Quigley interview, which was for ultimately that article. And in it, I've noticed that he sounded frazzled. And I thought maybe initially when I knew a lot less, I thought maybe some of the things that he had revealed had left him in basically this permanent paranoid state. But what it seems to be is that now that I know a little more, I have a little more context, as he's retelling some of the stories, not about the book, not just about the book being pirated, but also about the book being, in his eyes, misused to tell this politically motivated conspiracy theory. He names, I don't know if he names it, but you definitely name it in your article, Gary Allen in the book None Dare Call It a Conspiracy. And he's certainly aware of all this in the mid-1970s and pretty frustrated by it. So mm-hmm. he's saying that this is a distortion of what I was talking about, right? This is not a monolithic conspiracy run by the Jews or, you know, whatever other secretive group that you want to attach to it for your own ends. So mm-hmm. his frustration is understandable because I think it seems like he thought he had a really important historical work that was objective and mm-hmm. necessary considering what a significant role these individuals and these groups had played in the shaping of history in the first half of the 20th century anyway. So do you want to just give us an abstract of what the article is? And then I do have a couple notes that I wanted to go over, and I think we can wrap up after that.
Sure. Yeah, that sounds good. I had came across the audio file online that was posted. Based on my archive.org search, I've seen that there's been reference to this audio file since 1998. And it's an interview between a Washington Post Sunday Magazine personalities reporter who's also an investigative journalist at the time, and it was called The Professor Who Knew Too Much. And what I didn't know was that this article had been written upon that audio file. So what the public got essentially was the background interview that would have been conducted for a print interview. So you get to see how a reporter, you know, goes into a whole hour, you know, 45-minute long conversation with Carol Quigley, and then what comes out of it in the article that follows. And what I discovered was that what came out of it was a lot of partisan strawmen and omissions of what Carol Quigley was actually talking about. And it kind of framed Carol Quigley's work in a way that, you know, tried to paint it as not being historically significant unless you were of the ultra-right or ultra-fringe, you know, lunatic fringe or whatever he called it at the time. Now, the article was written by Rudy Maxa. That's who I believe is also in the audio file as well. Rudy Maxa is a pretty well-known travel expert on, has his own show on PBS. I'm not familiar with his credentials other than that. I think he was a Washington Post reporter throughout the 1970s and then maybe went on to Spy Magazine, if I remember correctly, but mm-hmm. you'd have to check that. So, you know, what I really wanted to do was try to highlight, first of all, that this is, in fact, the article that was written from the audio, and then to point out the discrepancies of what he left out. And what he left out is just huge. You know, he does present some of the points that Quigley has made against Gary Allen and Skousen, who are two individuals that wrote None Dare Call It a Conspiracy and The Naked Capitalist. And both of these works, you know, took a lot from Carol Quigley, but placed it within their own historical biases or within their own political biases. And Quigley states that it was the John Birch Society that printed up a lot of None Dare Call It a Conspiracy. And this is not at all my point to say that the John Birch Society, all across the board made the wrong interpretation of Quigley's work. But what I can show is that there is validity to Quigley's statements that some of them did. Some people within that organization did, acting as individuals or acting within it. That you be the judge. But there was an individual by the name of Myron Fagan who was a playwright back in the 1960s. And right after Carol Quigley's Tragedy and Hope came out, he started publishing many, many articles and put them to record on vinyl called the Illuminati, I think parts 1 through 4, mm-hmm. in which he put the Illuminati banner with the CFR in sniper scope crosshairs. So you're associating the Bavarian Illuminati, which is a historical group that existed in Bavaria in 1776, and to a group that came out of England and it was perpetuating a whole different kind of unity. And the reason why he was saying that they were the same group was that, and I kid you not, because some of them had Jewish last names or German last names that they changed because of certain reasons. And when I looked into the individuals that he claimed were in the Illuminati and in the CFR, it's just, it did not add up.
So he's kind of making a collage his own political purposes, essentially.
Yeah, absolutely. And it wouldn't be my allegation that it was on purpose, but it was definitely irresponsible. And I think it's really at the basis for, you know, some of the way it's discussed online, where anything that reeks of secrecy is referred to as the Illuminati rather than as, you know, what it is at the time. So, you know, in calling the secret society that Quigley, you know, he definitely unearthed a secret society that had many plans, but he did not say that they were the Bavarian Illuminati or that they were the same people. Now, a key point that I want to make is that if anybody out there has proof that the Illuminati was funded by Meyer Amschel Rothschild, and then we can show that Nathan Rothschild funded Rhodes's legacy, then maybe we can start having a conversation. But there's really no sources that show that, as I've been studying this for, you know, over 10 years. And, you know, there's a lot of speculation in order to make leaps in logic and leaps in history that fill in gaps that you can't just do that with. You know, it's you have to take the facts for what they are. And you can't have it both ways. Thomas Jefferson can't be the greatest guy that could lead to individual liberty again, but also think Adam Weishaupt is a great dude.
Sure.
So, you know, we need to have those conversations.
But the other thing, too, and, you know, correct me if you think I'm wrong here, but even that establishing that Rothschild connection, just from a historical standpoint here of doing the research in the beginning, is flimsy to me, because here's a family that's existed for generations, for centuries, right? And we also have the idea of there are societies that keep secrets. There are societies, and this is no secret. You know, people understand that most people who are Freemasons, that's, you know, no big deal. You know, it's in every town. There was a protected inner core of that. Other groups saw as something that could be used. So when you have a society that has a model of an external face, an exoteric face, but esoteric operations, then people say, well, what do they do right? What do they do wrong? Mm-hmm. What could we do better? How is that model useful to us? So you might see some continuity of sharing ideas or maybe even stealing ideas, because secret societies or societies with secrets have existed for thousands of years. But that doesn't mean that there is some kind of collusive continuity in all of it.
To all of it. No, absolutely not. And that's really my point. My point is not to say that the Illuminati didn't do a lot of things that people would be opposed to and that their own. But my point is that their edicts and their plans stand on their own throughout history. And they need to be put in the proper context. You know, people have the conversation about the Illuminati, but they don't necessarily put it within the context of where this group was living. They were living in the last throes of the Holy Roman Empire. And their goal was to try to subvert Freemasonry in order to use it in ways that it wasn't being used at the time in Germany, where Freemasonry has existed, according to Reinhard Koselleck, as a check, a moral check on states through ritual and through imparted morals through ritual and mythology, essentially. You know, they sought to take over Freemasonry in which to abolish the state.
Yeah.
Now, that doesn't mean that they didn't work with many princes and people of nobility in order to get a quote unquote on the level. That's where, you know, on the level in Freemasonry comes from, is that you could be on the level with a potentate or king or whoever as somebody, you know, who swept the street if you were in that environment, because you could actually discuss things that could not be discussed in the public sphere. Now, most of the time, you're going to be dealing with people that were of the higher classes anyway, and that have access to the ability to read and write and speak and, you know, do all of these things that are necessary to communicate and to collaborate in those ways. So, you know, as far as what you mentioned with Freemasonry, I can't say enough. There's a book out called Builders of Empire by Jessica Harlan Jacobs, which thoroughly shows how since the at least early 1800s, Freemasonry worldwide has been a tool of British Empire. And it shows how, you know, they go into the gold fields lodges in South Africa and set them up along the same routes. the area into you know, the sacred orders. So there's always going to be a questioning of secret societies. You know, John Quincy Adams, the president of the United States, whose father was John Adams, you know, he questioned Freemasonry quite extensively. And then there's Thomas Paine, who, you know, after he died, they published On the Origins of Freemasonry, which, you know, really is a scathing, you know, kind of summary of what he feels Freemasonry was. And, you know, and whether or not he was a Mason or not, I've not been able to find out. But he was on a list of people given by the Elector of Bavaria to the government next door in Austria of being a member in the Illuminati. So when you start looking at, you know, letters to Thomas Jefferson about the Illuminati, you start looking at things from George Washington within the religious community who were afraid that the Illuminati wanted to upset all Christianity. And then you look at how the founding fathers were mostly deist and would probably agree with a lot of their assessments on Christianity, and how Thomas Jefferson wrote his own Bible in that regard, you know, to take out many of the deifications. But if I could take it back to, you know, back to the point, you know, I would just say that with this this Quigley article, my main goal was to try to allow people to look at it neutrally again, because unfortunately, you know, while Gary Allen and Skousen may have done some great work to tell people that this book existed, I didn't come at Quigley's book through those sources. Mm-hmm. And so I feel glad that I don't have that spin in which I would have had to, you know, kind of go through first in order to understand what was being said. Now, this doesn't make anything Quigley said less important. There's a whole period of history that we and I can't speak for you, but we didn't get in school. You know, you don't get a whole period of history from the War of 1812 through how the United States establishes this special relationship again. And it's largely through, business ventures of the wealthy elite and those that set up the Pilgrim Society and fostered this quote unquote special relationship that from the British side is what they wanted all along. They wanted the United States to be, basically a proxy puppet for their original designs and to bring them back under British dominion. It's not only, you know, Cecil Rhodes that had those ideas, as is evidenced by those that followed his last will and testament.
Sure. And as G. Edward Griffin pointed out, you know, when you have these power structures, they are going to attract bad people. So we might have a variety of different, I don't even want to call them schemes, but designs for what the world should be, what the Atlantic world should be. There was actually an interesting quote that I'm reminded of after just saying that I wanted to share from your article. But I also, I do understand, just as a side note here, Quigley's frustration as far as signaling in on what's really important when he thought he had produced this very valuable historical work, you know, save all the problems that he had with the publishing and the destruction of the book. But how much of the what we'll call the modern conspiracy dialogue has used Tragedy and Hope really through Gary Allen's work or people like Gary Allen as a jumping off point? I would be incredibly frustrated if it was circulating online that, you know, School Sucks podcast is really about the Jews. You know, that would be very troubling for me. Sure. But could somebody, and we've even talked about this on the show, and we were talking about how Friedrich Nietzsche was Hitler's favorite philosopher. And if Friedrich Nietzsche was brought back to life in 1950, how absolutely horrified he would be to learn that, you know? So, I can see that, you know, when you consider yourself a serious, and I'm assuming that Quigley, aside from the fact that he agreed with the general agenda of these groups, probably considered himself fairly objective as a historian, more so than many, and to become aware of this distortion that was happening in the 1970s. So back to what I was saying just a minute ago, there is a quote from Quigley that I found interesting as far as designs for the world are concerned. He says, "I began to put these things together and I discovered that this group was working for the following things. They were a secret group. They were looking to federate the English-speaking world. They were closely linked to international bankers. They were working to establish a world, what I call a three-power world. That three-power world was the Atlantic bloc of England and the Commonwealth and the United States. Germany, Hitler's Germany, and Soviet Russia, a three-power world. They said Germany would be controlled because, and this is all in my book, this is from the audio, by the way, if I didn't mention that, it's boxed in between the Atlantic bloc and the Russians. The Russians will behave because they are boxed in between the Atlantic bloc, the American Navy in Singapore, and the Germans. This has all been described in my book. Notice it is a balance of power system. It's essentially what Kissinger, although he doesn't know what he's doing, he's bungling everything because he's just a prima donna, emotionally imbalanced person. He doesn't know what the hell he's doing, unquote. So basically what he goes on to say is that these people were for world domination, and the group I'm talking about were not. So, and when he says these people, he's talking about the people that Skousen and Allen are describing in their books. And he's saying that, yeah, I don't think that we're talking about the new world order in the sense that people use it today. They were talking about a balance of power system. Mostly their role seemed to be focused on the Atlantic world.
Yeah, that's what I found as well through Quigley's own words. Now, it's also important to note that I've found, this will be in the book as well, I found some personal documents of Milner and others where they discuss the Union Now project, which is really the basis of that kind of Atlantic bloc building that they were doing. But it's really a larger component of what becomes, you know, the World Federalist Movement in the United States. And that's a kind of a leap right there, but that is verified by facts. I can show that within the brain model as well as within the book and sources. But this Atlantic bloc that they hope to set up, they were really latching on to an American Rhodes Scholar by the name of Clarence Strife, and his goal that, you know, it was something that he wrote based on the interpretations of Cecil Rhodes as well as where the world could go. So at the time, yes, their goal was to establish this Atlantic bloc first and foremost in order for the United States to be swayed from its isolationist positions and to be brought back in, at least in some way, into the Imperial Commonwealth. It used to be known as the British Empire, but thanks to Lionel Curtis, who started the Royal Institute of International Affairs, it was changed to the Commonwealth. So, yeah, it's not the end all of what they sought to accomplish. But at the time, this is the best option they saw for accomplishing those same goals. So we can show, a continuity, today, even through the international relations philosophies. Remember, we discussed earlier how international relations discipline gets crafted by these same individuals that would later go on to create the theories that live within that. So we're talking about logic inside of a logic that's already been accepted that we weren't a privy to, you know, that we're going to all of a sudden not care about American sovereignty anymore, and we're going to a Western civilization model or an Anglo-Saxon model. And because Great Britain was supposedly on the wayside, America needed to come to its aid because otherwise it was going to be swallowed up, and, you know, we have the end of history
right.
again. You know, this is that fear that if the United States gets to perpetuate its own principles and remains isolationist in that way, and as an example, then their whole lineage of history is going to die. Their birth of the civil polity that created the United States, without a doubt, because you can look at the United States constitutions and the balance of government structures, and the variations are you know, very few and far between if you just substitute parliament and substitute queen and so, you know, or king. So if you look at, you know, what they were trying to accomplish, it wasn't only, you know, through governmental structures and through creating this Atlantic bloc. It was also through ecumenical movements. You know, some of these people were devoutly religious along Christian lines, and some of them were using Christianity and more so ecumenicism, a world theology, as a way to, you know, to usurp particularity. So when you're talking about like something like the American Revolution, where you have, many religious sects that pop up in opposition to the official Church of England, you have a universal and then you have particulars. And then if you talk about Henry VIII and you talk about the Roman Catholic Church, you have universal and then you have particulars, because you're changing the story along the way to fit certain guidelines or certain changes in thinking. So with the ecumenical movement, it started by many within the Rhodes Roundtable group. They sought to unify through a World Council of Churches with Lionel Curtis, working with John Foster Dulles in the United States with the Federal Union Project. It was Union Now, the Federal Union Project, as well as the English-speaking Union, that all went hand in hand. And when you said earlier, quoting Cecil Rhodes and quoting Quigley about the English-speaking Union in trying to, you know, unify English-speaking people, they were very much behind the drive of what was called Basic English, in which they sought to create an 850-word substrata of language that would be disseminated to non-English-speaking places in order to open it up for commerce and colonization, and for, you know, telling the barbarians that they have no intrinsic value in life, and that you need to come to our way of life in order to be civilized. That's the whole process of being civilized. Whether you're talking about the Native Americans, you're talking about Jesuits who use the same type of organizational, educational and organizational structure to tell other people that their intrinsic value was null and void, and that you have no value unless you're in our group.
So I think what we're driving at here, and to put it simply, and I think this is also a nice way for us to wrap up, when you look at the complexity and you start to see maybe at best a deep philosophic corruption in these people, but for, in their eyes, a greater good, it allows us to start to de-cartoonify history a little bit, where, you know, our framework for understanding history began with a cartoon, like a Saturday morning Super Friends cartoon, where they come on a boat and they, you know, they have some, you know, hard times, and then they prevail. And then, you know, a couple hundred years later, some people have some hard times, and then they prevail. And, you know, they are the pantheon of America. That's what they become. So it makes sense that as people start to learn, as you almost have to exert effort to maintain that government school created ignorance in the information world of today, as we start to learn that the world is more complex, it makes sense. And people, you really can't even fault them initially for embracing a new cartoon version of history, where we don't see the details, we don't understand the philosophy, we don't understand the origins ideologically of the Rhodes Roundtable movement throughout the 20th century. We categorize it as evil. We are left with this tremendous amount of enemy imagery. And I like Gary Allen's book. I think it's a great introduction to a lot of these ideas, but it fits the description that I just gave. So if people, you know, have the time and the motivation to do this work, hopefully tonight we've provided some valuable vocabulary and some guidelines as far as methodology is concerned. And Kevin, I certainly continue to be impressed by not only the breadth, but the depth of your knowledge. And I certainly look forward to working with you again in the future.
Oh, absolutely. Me too. Thank you, Brad. And I've enjoyed your podcast for a very long time. And to add to that point you just made, which was so great about history, you know, and undoing history and how that works, you know, I would point people to a recent discovery in southeastern Turkey of a archaeological site called Göbekli Tepe, yep, which means potbelly hill. Which, if you're familiar with this story, it's completely, you know, nullified most of what people have commonly accepted for most of their lives, lived and died many years before us as human, as our origins. So, you know, you have to understand that you have to question the authorities or the auctors or the authors of these boundary myths or boundary ideas of what we are and what we're doing here. And it's the same way with an encyclopedia. You have to look at it and say, why are they leaving this out? Why is that not important? Who put this together? Why is it like that? So you constantly have to revisit that, just like we have to constantly revisit history. There are whole lives and whole generations of people that believe that, you know, that human history went one way, and that they believe that their whole life, and maybe it helped them for that period of time. But then we're going down Joseph Campbell's route, and we'll have to have that conversation another
day. Yeah, absolutely. So, for those who don't know, Göbekli Tepe, I'm probably not pronouncing that perfectly, was basically an urban civilization, I think, that they discovered recently, and it's been dated back, what is it, Kevin, like 12 or 14,000 years?
Yeah, I thought they said 6,000 years before the pyramid.
6,000.
I'd have to check. Yeah, I'd have to check the exact where they're dating it.
So that's roughly 10 or 11,000 years ago, which is, you know, predates by a long shot the earliest civilizations of Mesopotamia and Egypt. So it's a very interesting story. One caveat, the ancient aliens people on the History Channel have been all over this. They love this story because they think that they can, take this discovery and from there kind of sidestep their way into, aliens did it.
Yeah, I'm just glad we have a history show to turn to that actually uses facts and it relies on facts throughout history because you said the same sentence, ancient aliens and history show. If you're going to speculate, then that's fine, but it's become a parody of itself.
So, yeah.
I've not seen the ancient alien aspect of this particular find, but I just find the conceptual knowledge of, discovery that can change human history and what most people know and accept in their daily lives, just extremely fascinating and, just a life-affirming type experience for people to look at it, and say, hey, whole people have believed one way their whole life, and then we have discoveries that contradict that and bring that up to the present, and that's how things are ran. So,
excellent. I'm actually going to end the show with you talking, so we'll just kind of do music out from there.
Sure.
So yeah, thanks again for taking the time to have this conversation. What I'm probably going to do is two versions of this show. One is going to be short, more of like a bullet point version, and then one version that's unedited. That's our whole conversation, because I have to keep in mind, younger audience and what the processing abilities are for the amount of information. And I hope people, will get better at that. You know what I mean? But I do like to have kind of a distilled version of what we talked about as well. So I have, a full version of our history show. And then I have a version that I think was about 15 minutes shorter that I painstakingly edited for about... I set like a cap on what I wanted the time to be for our whole talk, and then painstakingly edited 15 minutes out of it, like listening to it over and over and over again, trying to figure out what could go. But obviously wanted to have the full version available as well. So if you see one version that's shorter, I just wanted to let you know what my method is.
Yeah, good deal. Yeah, and we have many other opportunities to do this in the future. And sometimes it's hard to pack it all into one show. And I thought, maybe with that last one, I might've went off on a few. So
yeah. The feedback was definitely generally positive. So, people thought you did a good job. And like I said, they were impressed. I've gotten a lot of positive feedback about the work I've been doing with Rich lately. So, awesome. I'm looking forward to continuing. Like I think, what we do, as he has said, is complimentary. So,
yeah. Oh, I totally agree. Thank you so much for having me, and I look forward to doing it again sometime.
All right, my pleasure. I'll let you go. Have a good night, and I'll talk to you again soon.
All right. Take care.
Bye.
Peace.
Okay. Now we'll just hello, people in the chat.